arrived late at night. When I awoke the next morning, I walked onto a tiny balcony and found myself looking out at the very bay where 17 years earlier, I had made the decision to quit Maine. I collapsed into a chair, overcome with emotion. Throughout the week, I spent much of my free time on that balcony, looking down at Leinster Bay, trying to understand my feelings. I came to realize that although I had quit, I had not taken the next step, and that my decision to remain in the middle was exacting a devastating toll. By the end of the week, I had concluded that the world around me was not one that I wanted to dream, and that I needed to do exactly what I was instructing my students to do. To do whatever it would take to change my dreams in ways that reflected what I really wanted in my life. When I returned home, I gave up my corporate consulting practice. The president of SWEC who had hired me was now retired. A new man had come aboard, one who was younger than me and was apparently unconcerned about me telling my story. He had initiated a cost-cutting program and was happy not to have to pay me that exorbitant retainer any longer. I decided to complete the book I had been working on for so long, and just making the decision brought a wonderful sense of relief. I shared my ideas about writing with close friends, mostly people in the nonprofit world who were involved with indigenous cultures and rainforest preservation. To my surprise, they were dismayed. They feared that speaking out would undermine my teaching work and jeopardize the nonprofit organizations I supported. Many of us were helping Amazon nations protect their lands from oil companies. Coming clean, I was told, could undermine my credibility and might set back the whole movement. Some even threatened to withdraw their support. So once again, I stopped writing. Instead, I focused on taking people deep into the Amazon, showing them a place that is mostly untouched by the modern world, and introducing them to people who continue to live in harmony with nature. In fact, that is where I was on September 11th, 2001. Chapter 32. September 11th and its aftermath, for me, personally. On September 10th, 2001, I was traveling down a river in the Ecuadorian Amazon with Shakaim Chumpi, the co-author of my book Spirit of the Shuar. We were leading a group of 16 North Americans to his community deep in the rainforest. The visitors had come to learn about his people and to help them preserve their precious rainforests. Shakaim had fought as a soldier in the recent Ecuador-Peru conflict. Most people in the major oil-consuming nations have never heard about this war, yet it was fought primarily to provide them with oil. Although the border between these two countries had been disputed for many years, only recently did a resolution become urgent. The reason for the urgency was that the oil companies needed to know which country to negotiate in order to win concessions for specific tracts of the oil-rich lands. Borders had to be defined. The Shuar formed Ecuador's first line of defense. They proved themselves to be ferocious fighters, often overcoming superior numbers and better equipped forces. The Shuar did not know anything about the politics behind the war, or that its resolution would open the door to oil companies. They fought because they came from a long tradition of warriors, and because they were not about to allow foreign soldiers onto their lands. As we paddled down the river, watching a flock of chattering parrots fly overhead, I asked Shakaim whether the truce was still holding. "Yes," he said, "but I'm afraid I must tell you that we are now preparing to go to war with you." He went on to explain that, of course, he did not mean me personally or the people in our group. "You are our friends," he assured me. He was, he said, referring to our oil companies and to the military forces that would come into his jungle to defend them. "We've seen what they did to the Warani. They destroyed their forests, polluted the rivers, and killed many people, including children. Today the Warani hardly exist as a people anymore. We won't let that happen to us. We won't allow oil companies into our territory any more than we would the Peruvians. We have all sworn to fight to the last man." That night our group sat around a fire in the center of a beautiful Shuar longhouse built from split bamboo slats, placed in the ground and covered with a thatched roof. I told them about my conversation with Shakaim. We all wondered how many other people in the world felt similarly about our oil companies and our country. How many, like the Shuar, were terrified that we would come into their lives and destroy their culture and their lands? How many hated us? The next morning, I went down to the little office where we kept our two-way radio. I needed to arrange for pilots to fly in and pick us up in a few days. As I was talking to them, I heard a shout. "My God!" the man on the other end of the radio exclaimed. "New York is under attack!" He turned up the commercial radio that had been playing music in the background. During the next half hour, we received a minute-by-minute account of the events unfolding in the United States. Like everyone else, I shall never forget that experience. When I returned to my home in Florida, I knew I had to visit Ground Zero, the former site of the World Trade Center towers. So I arranged to fly to New York. I checked into my uptown hotel in early afternoon. It was a sunny November day, unseasonably balmy. I strolled along Central Park, filled with enthusiasm, then headed for a part of the city where once I had spent a lot of time. As I approached Ground Zero, my enthusiasm was replaced with a sense of horror. The sights and smells were overwhelming. The incredible destruction, the twisted and melted skeletons of those once great buildings, the debris, the rancid odor of smoke, charred ruins, and what I took to be burnt flesh. I had seen it all on TV, but being here was different. I had not been prepared for this, especially not for the people. They stood around, those who lived or worked nearby, those who had survived. An Egyptian man was loitering outside his small shoe repair shop, shaking his head in disbelief. "Can't get used to it," he muttered. "I lost many customers, many friends. My nephew died up there." He pointed at the blue sky. "I think I saw him jump. I don't know. So many were jumping, holding hands and flapping their arms as though they could fly." It came as a surprise, the way people talked with one another. In New York City. And it went beyond language. Their eyes met. Although somber, they exchanged looks of compassion, half smiles that spoke more than a million words. But there was something else, a sense about the place itself. At first I couldn't figure it out. Then it struck me. The light. Lower Manhattan had been a dark canyon, back in the days when I made the pilgrimage to this part of town to raise capital for IPS, when I used to plot strategy with my investment bankers over dinner at Windows on the World. You had to go that high, to the top of the World Trade Center, if you wanted to see light. Now, here it was at street level. The canyon had been split wide open, and we who stood on the street beside the ruins were warmed by the sunshine. I couldn't help wondering if the view of the sky, of the light, had helped people open their hearts. I felt guilty just thinking such thoughts. I turned the corner at Trinity Church and headed down Wall Street, back to the old New York, enveloped in shadow. No sky, no light. People hurried along the sidewalk, ignoring one another. A cop screamed at a stalled car. I sat down on the first steps I came to, at number 14. From somewhere, the sounds of giant fans or an air blower rose above the other noises. It seemed to come from the massive stone wall of the New York Stock Exchange building. I watched the people. They hustled up and down the street, leaving their offices, hurrying home, or heading to a restaurant or bar to discuss business. A few walked in tandem and chatted with each other. Most, though, were alone and silent. I tried to make eye contact. It didn't happen. The wail of a car alarm drew my attention down the street. A man rushed out of an office and pointed a key at the car. The alarm went silent. I sat there quietly for a few long moments. After a while, I reached into my pocket and pulled out a neatly folded piece of paper covered with statistics. Then I saw him. He shuffled along the street, staring down at his feet. He had a scrawny gray beard and wore a grimy overcoat that looked especially out of place on this warm afternoon on Wall Street. He looked to be Afghan. He glanced at me. Then, after only a second of hesitation, he started up the steps. He nodded politely and sat down beside me, leaving a yard or two between us. From the way he looked straight ahead, I realized it would be up to me to begin the conversation. Nice afternoon. Beautiful. His accent was thick. Times like these, we want sunshine. You mean because of the World Trade Center? He nodded. You're from Afghanistan? He stared at me. Is it so obvious? I've traveled a lot. Recently, I visited the Himalayas, Kashmir. Kashmir. He pulled at his beard. Fighting. Yes, India and Pakistan. Hindus and Muslims. Makes you wonder about religion, doesn't it? His eyes met mine. They were deep brown, nearly black. They struck me as wise and sad. He turned back toward the New York Stock Exchange building. With a long, gnarled finger, he pointed at the building. Or maybe, I agreed. It's about economics, not religion. You were a soldier? I couldn't help but chuckle. No, an economic consultant. I handed him the paper with the statistics. These were my weapons. He reached over and took the paper. Numbers. World statistics. He studied the list, then gave a little laugh. I can't read. He handed it back to me. The numbers tell us that 24,000 people die every day from hunger. I didn't bother to mention that slightly fewer than 3,000 had died at Ground Zero on 9/11. He whistled softly, then took a moment to think about this, and sighed. I was almost one of them. I had a little pomegranate farm near Kandahar. Russians arrived and Mujahideen hid behind trees and in water ditches. He raised his hands and pointed them like a rifle. Ambushing. He lowered his hands. All my trees and ditches were destroyed. After that, what did you do? He nodded at the list I held. Does it show beggars? It did not, but I thought I remembered. About 80 million in the world, I believe. I was one. He shook his head, seemed lost in thought. We sat in silence for a few minutes before he spoke again. I do not like beggaring. My child dies, so I raise puppies. Opium? He shrugged. No trees, no water. The only way to feed our families. I felt a lump in my throat, a depressing sense of sadness combined with guilt. We call raising opium poppies evil. Yet many of our wealthiest people owe their fortunes to the drug trade. His eyes met mine and seemed to penetrate my soul. You were a soldier, he stated, nodding his head to confirm this simple fact. Then he rose slowly to his feet and hobbled down the steps. I wanted him to stay, but I felt powerless to say anything. I managed to get to my feet and start after him. At the bottom of the steps, I was stopped by a sign. It included a picture of the building where I had been seated. At the top, it notified passers-by that the sign had been erected by Heritage Trails of New York. It said, "The Mausoleum of Halicarnassus, piled on top of the bell tower of St. Mark's in Venice, at the corner of Wall and Broad. That's the design concept behind 14 Wall Street. In its day, the world's tallest bank building, the 539-foot-high skyscraper originally housed the headquarters of Bankers Trust, one of the country's wealthiest financial institutions. I stood there in awe and looked up at this building. Shortly after the turn of the last century, 14 Wall Street had played the role that the World Trade Center would later assume. It had been the very symbol of power and economic domination. It had also housed Bankers Trust, one of the firms I had employed to finance my energy company. It was an essential part of my heritage. The heritage, as the old Afghan man had so aptly put it, of a soldier. That I had ended up here this day, talking with him, seemed an odd coincidence. Coincidence. The word stopped me. I thought about how our reactions to coincidences mold our lives. How should I react to this one? Continuing to walk, I scanned the heads in the crowd, but I could find no sign of the man. At the next building, there was an immense statue shrouded in blue plastic. An engraving on the building's stone face revealed that this was Federal Hall, 26 Wall Street, where on April 30, 1789, George Washington had taken the oath of office as first president of the United States. This was the exact spot where the first man given the responsibility to safeguard life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people was sworn in. So close to ground zero. Right on Wall Street. I went on around the block, to Pine Street. There I came face to face with the world headquarters of Chase, the bank that David Rockefeller built. A bank seeded with oil money and harvested by men like me. This bank, an institution that served the EHMs and that was a master at promoting global empire, was in many ways the very symbol of the corporatocracy. I recalled reading that the World Trade Center was a project started by David Rockefeller in 1960, and that in recent years the complex had been considered an albatross. It had the reputation of being a financial misfit, unsuited to modern fiber optic and internet technologies, and burdened with an inefficient and costly elevator system. Those two towers had once been nicknamed David and Nelson, Rockefeller. Now the albatross was gone. I kept walking, slowly, almost reluctantly. Despite the warmth of the afternoon, I felt a chill, and I realized that a strange anxiousness, a foreboding, had taken hold of me. I could not identify its source, and I tried to brush it off, picking up my pace. I eventually found myself once again looking at that smoldering hole, the twisted metal, that great scar in the earth. I leaned against the building that had escaped the destruction, and stared into the pit. I tried to imagine the people rushing out of the collapsing tower, and the firefighters dashing in to help them. I tried to think about the people who had jumped, the desperation they felt. But none of these things came to me. Instead, I saw Osama bin Laden accepting money and weapons worth millions of dollars from a man employed by a consulting company under contract to the United States government. Then I saw myself sitting at a computer with a blank screen. I looked around, away from Ground Zero, at the New York streets that had avoided the fire and now were returning to normal. I wondered what the people who walked those streets today thought about all this. Not simply about the destruction of the towers, but also about the ruined pomegranate farms and the 24,000 who starve every single day. I wondered if they thought about such things at all. If they could tear themselves away from their jobs and gas-guzzling cars and their interest payments long enough to consider their own contribution to the world they were passing on to their children. I wondered what they knew about Afghanistan. Not the Afghanistan on television, the one littered with U.S. military tents and tanks, but the old man's Afghanistan. I wondered what those 24,000 who die every day think. And then I saw myself again, sitting before a blank computer screen. I forced my attention back to Ground Zero. At the moment, one thing was certain. My country was thinking about revenge, and it was focusing on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. But I was thinking about all the other places in the world where people hate our companies, our military, our policies, and our march toward global empire. I wondered, what about Panama, Ecuador, Indonesia, Iran, Guatemala, most of Africa? I pushed myself off the wall I had been leaning against and started walking away. A short, swarthy man was waving a newspaper in the air and shouting in Spanish. I stopped. "Venezuela on the brink of revolution!" he yelled above the noise of the traffic, the honking horns and the milling people. I bought his paper and stood there for a moment scanning the lead article. It was about Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's democratically elected anti-American president, and the undercurrent of hatred generated by U.S. policies in Latin America. What about Venezuela? Chapter 33. Venezuela. Saved by Saddam. I had watched Venezuela for many years. It was a classic example of a country that rose from rags to riches as a result of oil. It was also a model of the turmoil that oil wealth foments. of the disequilibrium between rich and poor, and of a country shamelessly exploited by the corporatocracy. It had become the epitome of a place where old-style EHMs like me converged with the new-style corporate version. The events I read about in the newspaper that day at Ground Zero were a direct result of the 1998 elections, when the poor and disenfranchised of Venezuela elected Hugo Chavez by a landslide as their president. He immediately instituted drastic measures, taking control of the courts and other institutions and dissolving the Venezuelan Congress. He denounced the United States for its shameless imperialism, spoke out forcefully against globalization, and introduced a hydrocarbons law that was reminiscent, even in name, of the one Jaime Roldós had brought to Ecuador shortly before his plane went down. The law doubled the royalties charged to foreign oil companies. Then Chavez defied the traditional independence of the state-owned oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela, by replacing its top executives with people loyal to him. Venezuelan oil is crucial to economies around the world. In 2002, the nation was the world's fourth largest oil exporter and the number three supplier to the United States. Petróleos de Venezuela, with 40,000 employees and $50 billion a year in sales, provided 80% of the country's export revenue. It was by far the most important factor in Venezuela's economy. By taking over the industry, Chavez had thrust himself onto the world stage as a major player. Many Venezuelans saw this as destiny, the completion of a process that had begun 80 years earlier. On December 14, 1922, a huge oil blowout had gushed from the earth near Maracaibo. 100,000 barrels of crude sprayed into the air each day for the next 3 days, and this single geologic event changed Venezuela forever. By 1930, the country was the world's largest oil exporter. Venezuelans looked to oil as a solution to all their problems. Oil revenues during the next 40 years enabled Venezuela to evolve from one of the most impoverished nations in the world to one of the wealthiest in Latin America. All of the country's vital statistics improved: healthcare, education, employment, longevity, and infant survival rates. Businesses prospered. During the 1973 OPEC oil embargo, petroleum prices skyrocketed, and Venezuela's national budget quadrupled. The EHMs went to work. The international banks flooded the country with loans that paid for vast infrastructure and industrial projects and for the highest skyscrapers on the continent. Then, during the 1980s, the corporate-style EHMs arrived. It was an ideal opportunity for them to cut their fledgling teeth. The Venezuelan middle class had become sizable and provided a ripe market for a vast array of products. Yet there was still a very large poor sector available to labor in the sweatshops and factories. Then oil prices crashed, and Venezuela could not repay its debts. In 1989, the International Monetary Fund imposed harsh austerity measures and pressured Caracas to support the corporatocracy in many other ways. Venezuelans reacted violently. Riots killed more than 200 people. The illusion of oil as a bottomless source of support was shattered. From 1978 to 2003, Venezuela's per capita income plummeted by more than 40%. As poverty increased, resentment intensified. Polarization resulted, with the middle class pitted against the poor. As so often occurs in countries whose economies depend on oil production, demographics shifted radically. The sinking economy took its toll on the middle class, and many fell into the ranks of the poor. The new demographics set the stage for Chavez and for conflict with Washington. Once in power, the new president took actions that challenged the Bush administration. Just before the September 11th attacks, Washington was considering its options. The EHMs had failed. Was it time to send in the jackals? Then 9/11 changed all priorities. President Bush and his advisors focused on rallying the world community to support U.S. activities in Afghanistan and an invasion of Iraq. On top of that, the U.S. economy was in the middle of a recession. Venezuela was relegated to a back burner. However, it was obvious that at some point, Bush and Chavez would come to blows. With Iraqi and other Middle Eastern oil supplies threatened, Washington could not afford to ignore Venezuela for long. Wandering around Ground Zero and Wall Street, meeting the old Afghan man and reading about Chavez's Venezuela, brought me to a point I had avoided for many years, and it forced me to take a hard look at the consequences of the things I had done over the past 3 decades. I had previously recognized the effect of my EHM work, but I now considered how it might directly affect my daughter and her generation. This renewed my drive. I knew I could no longer postpone taking action to atone for what I had done. I had to come clean about my life. I had to do whatever it would take to wake people up to the fact of global injustice and help them to understand why so much of the world hates us. I started writing once again, but as I did so, it seemed to me that my story was too old. Somehow, I needed to bring it up to date. I considered traveling to Afghanistan, Iraq, and Venezuela, and writing a contemporary commentary on those 3 countries. They seemed to embody an irony of current world affairs. Each had undergone traumatic political turmoil and ended up with leaders who left a great deal to be desired: a cruel and despotic Taliban, a psychopathic Saddam, and a diplomatically inept Chavez. Yet in no case did the corporatocracy respond by attempting to solve the deeper problems of these countries. Rather, the response was simply to undermine leaders who stood in the way of our oil policies. In many respects, Venezuela was the most intriguing case because, although military intervention had already occurred in Afghanistan and appeared inevitable in Iraq, the administration's response to Chavez remained a mystery. As far as I was concerned, the issue was not about whether Chavez was a good leader. It was about Washington's reaction to a leader who stood in the way of the corporatocracy's march to global empire. Before I had time to organize such a trip, however, circumstances once again intervened. My nonprofit work took me to South America several times in 2002. A Venezuelan family whose businesses were going bankrupt under the Chavez regime joined one of my trips to the Amazon. We became close friends, and I heard their side of the story. I also met with Latin Americans from the other end of the economic spectrum, who considered Chavez a savior. The events unfolding in Caracas were symptomatic of the world we EHMs had created. By December 2002, the situations in both Venezuela and Iraq reached crisis points. The 2 countries were evolving into perfect counterpoints for each other. In Iraq, all the subtle efforts of both the EHMs and the Jackals had failed to force Saddam to comply, and now we were preparing for the ultimate solution: invasion. In Venezuela, the Bush administration was bringing Kermit Roosevelt's Iranian model into play. As the New York Times reported, hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans filled the streets here today to declare their commitment to a national strike, now in its 28th day, to force the ouster of President Hugo Chavez. The strike, joined by an estimated 30,000 oil workers, threatens to wreak havoc on this nation, the world's 5th largest oil producer, for months to come. In recent days, the strike has reached a kind of stalemate. Mr. Chavez is using non-striking workers to try to normalize operations at the state-owned oil company. His opponents, led by a coalition of businesses and labor leaders, contend, though, that their strike will push the company, and thus the Chavez government, to collapse. This was exactly how the CIA brought down Mossadegh and replaced him with the Shah. The analogy could not have been stronger. It seemed history was uncannily repeating itself, 50 years later. 5 decades, and still oil was the driving force. Chavez's supporters continued to clash with his opponents. Several people, it was reported, were shot to death, and dozens more were wounded. The next day, I talked with an old friend who for many years had been involved with the Jackals. Like me, he had never worked directly for any government, but he had led clandestine operations in many countries. He told me that a private contractor had approached him to foment strikes in Caracas and to bribe military officers, many of whom had been trained at the School of the Americas, to turn against their elected president. He had rejected the offer, but he confided, "The man who took the job knows what he's doing." Oil company executives and Wall Street feared a rise in oil prices and a decline in American inventories. Given the Middle East situation, I knew the Bush administration was doing everything in its power to overthrow Chavez. Then came the news that they had succeeded. Chavez had been ousted. The New York Times took this turn of events as an opportunity to provide a historical perspective, and to identify the man who appeared to play the Kermit Roosevelt role in contemporary Venezuela. The United States supported authoritarian regimes throughout Central and South America during and after the Cold War in defense of its economic and political interests. In tiny Guatemala, the Central Intelligence Agency mounted a coup, overthrowing the democratically elected government in 1954. And it backed subsequent right-wing governments against small leftist rebel groups for four decades. Roughly 200,000 civilians died. In Chile, a CIA-supported coup helped put General Augusto Pinochet in power from 1973 to 1990. In Peru, a fragile democratic government is still unraveling the agency's role in a decade of support for the now deposed and disgraced President Alberto K. Fujimori and his disreputable spy chief, Vladimiro L. Montesinos. The United States had to invade Panama in 1989 to topple its narco-dictator, Manuel A. Noriega, who, for almost 20 years, was a valued informant for American intelligence. And the struggle to mount an unarmed opposition against Nicaragua's leftists in the 1980s by any means necessary, including selling arms to Iran for cold cash, led to indictments against senior Reagan administration officials. Among those investigated back then was Otto J. Reich, a veteran of Latin American struggles. No charges were ever filed against Mr. Reich. He later became United States Ambassador to Venezuela and now serves as Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs by presidential appointment. The fall of Mr. Chavez is a feather in his cap. If Reich and the Bush administration were celebrating the coup against Chavez, the party was suddenly cut short. In an amazing turnabout, Chavez regained the upper hand and was back in power less than 72 hours later. Unlike Mossadegh in Iran, Chavez had managed to keep the military on his side, despite all attempts to turn its high-ranking officers against him. In addition, he had the powerful state oil company on his side. Petróleos de Venezuela defied the thousands of striking workers and made a comeback. After the dust cleared, Chavez tightened his government's grip on oil company employees, purged the military of the few disloyal officers who had been persuaded to betray him, and forced many of his key opponents out of the country. He demanded 20-year prison terms for two prominent opposition leaders, Washington-connected operatives who had joined the jackals to direct the nationwide strike. In the final analysis, the entire sequence of events was a calamity for the Bush administration. As the Los Angeles Times reported, Bush administration officials acknowledged Tuesday that they had discussed the removal of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for months with military and civilian leaders from Venezuela. The administration's handling of the abortive coup has come under increasing scrutiny. It was obvious that not only had the EHMs failed, but so had the jackals. Venezuela in 2003 turned out to be very different from Iran in 1953. I wondered if this was a harbinger, or simply an anomaly, and what Washington would do next. At least for the time being, I believe a serious crisis was averted in Venezuela, and Chavez was saved by Saddam Hussein. The Bush administration could not take on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Venezuela all at once. At the moment, it had neither the military muscle nor the political support to do so. I knew, however, that such circumstances could change quickly, and that President Chavez was likely to face fierce opposition in the near future. Nonetheless, Venezuela was a reminder that not much had changed in 50 years, except that particular outcome. When I wrote those words in the first edition of this book, I had no idea that Chavez would be dead within a few years. The United States would be mired in endless wars in the Middle East. Russia would reemerge on the world stage. Chinese EHMs would outsmart their Western counterparts and threaten U.S. hegemony on every continent. The corporatocracy would reign over history's first truly global empire. In fact, the next 12 years would tell a completely different story from all the others that preceded them. Part 5. 2004 to today. Chapter 34. Conspiracy. Was I poisoned? The situation has gotten much worse since Confessions of an Economic Hitman was first published. 12 years ago, I expected that books like mine would wake people up and inspire them to turn things around. The facts were obvious. I and others like me had created an EHM system that supported the corporatocracy. Together, the EHMs, corporate magnates, Wall Street robber barons, governments, and jackals, and all their networks around the world have created a global economy that fails everyone. It is based on war, or the threat of war, debt, an extreme form of materialism that pillages the Earth's resources and is consuming itself into extinction. In the end, even the very rich will fall victim to this death economy. Most of us have bought into it in a big way. We are collaborators, often unconscious ones. Now it is time to change. I had hoped that exposing these facts, making people conscious, would inspire a movement that by 2016 would have resulted in a new vision, a new story. People were in fact shaken awake. Activities in so many parts of the world, including localized ones such as the Occupy movements, national ones in places as diverse as Iceland, Ecuador, and Greece, and regional ones, such as the Arab Spring, and Latin America's Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our America, ALBA, have demonstrated that we understand our world is collapsing. What I had not anticipated was the flexibility in the EHM system, or its absolute determination to defend and promote the death economy. I had not anticipated the rise of an entirely new class of EHMs and jackals. I made it clear in the original book that I did not believe the EHM system was driven by some nefarious, illegal, secret plan devised by a small group of people determined to control the world. In other words, I did not believe in some unified, grand conspiracy. Then something strange happened. In late March 2005, less than 5 months after publication of the book, I flew to New York City on a Monday. I was scheduled to speak at the United Nations the next day. I was in perfect health, as far as I knew. A man who identified himself only as a freelance journalist had been hounding my publicist for an interview. Because his credentials were sketchy and I was receiving a lot of press at that time, she kept putting him off. But when he suggested picking me up at LaGuardia Airport, taking me to lunch, and driving me to the apartment where I was staying with a friend, she consulted with me and I acquiesced. He was waiting for me when I exited the airport. He took me to a small cafe, told me how much he admired my book, asked some of what had become rather standard questions about my life as an EHM, and then drove me to my friend's apartment on the Upper West Side. I never saw that man again, and meeting him would have been an unmemorable event, except that a couple hours later, I suffered severe internal bleeding. I lost about half the blood in my body, went into shock, and was rushed to Lenox Hill Hospital. I ended up spending 2 weeks there and having more than 70% of my large intestine removed. As I lay recovering in that hospital bed, I thought that perhaps my illness was a message to slow down, that my body was overtaxed and I needed to cut back on writing and the speaking tours. The New York gastroenterologist told me that I'd suffered from complications due to a severe case of diverticulosis. I was shocked to hear this, because I'd recently had a colonoscopy. My Florida doctor had assured me that there were no signs of cancer, which had been my main concern. He mentioned that I had some diverticula, like most people your age, and ended by advising me to come back in 5 years. Of course, my UN speech was canceled, as were numerous other media events. Word of my operation got out very quickly, and soon I was receiving lots of emails. Most supported me and expressed concern for my well-being. Some emails came from people who accused me of being a traitor to my country. Several assured me that I'd been poisoned. When I asked my gastroenterologist, he responded that he was quite certain I hadn't been poisoned, but that he'd also learned never to say never. In any case, all of it got me to thinking and reading more about conspiracies. I still do not believe in the grand conspiracy theory. In my experience, there is no secret club of individuals who get together to plot illegal, world-dominating strategies. However, I do know that part of the power of the EHM system is that it foments many small conspiracies. By small, I mean that they are focused on specific objectives. Such conspiracies, secret actions to accomplish illegal goals, happened when I was just beginning school, such as the CIA coup that replaced the democratically elected Iranian Prime Minister, Mossadegh, with the Shah in 1953. They continued during my high school years. Consider the CIA-supported Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1963. But I became most aware of them when I was in EHM, and the CIA arranged the assassinations of my two clients, Ecuador's Rodos and Panama's Torrijos, in 1981. Then, as I began writing the original of this book in 2002, there was the U.S.-led conspiracy to overthrow Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez. After that came the conspiratorial lie about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This was followed by a flurry of conspiracies against leaders and governments in the Middle East and Africa. While I was in EHM, the goals of most conspiracies were to further U.S. and corporate interests in the economically developing countries. To do whatever it took, including overthrowing or killing government leaders, to enable our companies to exploit resources. After my colon operation, as I lounged around my home reading various reports, it became obvious that the tools I had used in Indonesia, Panama, Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and other countries were now being applied in Europe and the United States. Fortified by the so-called threat of global terrorism after 9/11, these conspiracies have given excessive power to the very wealthy individuals who control global corporations. Among the most striking are conspiracies to implement free trade agreements such as NAFTA and CAFTA, and the more recent Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, which empower corporations to assume de facto sovereignty over governments in countries around the world. To convince politicians to pass laws that permit the rich to avoid paying taxes, to control the media, and to use media to influence politics, and to terrify U.S. citizens into fighting endless wars. These and many other conspiracies took the EHM system far beyond where it had been in the 1970s. Despite all that I had written, I had to admit that I'd missed much of what had been going on beneath the surface. The old tools had been sharpened and new ones invented. The heart of this system remained the same. An economic and political ideology based on enslavement through debt and enforced by paralyzing people with fear. In my day, it had convinced the majority of Americans and much of the rest of the world that all actions were justified if they protected us from communist subversives. The fear had now switched to Muslim terrorists, immigrants, and anyone threatening to rein in corporations. The dogma was similar, but the impact was now much greater. Recuperating from that operation also sent me into the dark abyss of guilt. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, haunted by memories of leaders I'd bribed and threatened. I had not yet come to terms with my EHM past. I asked myself why I'd stayed in that job for 10 long years, and then I realized how difficult it had been to escape. It wasn't just the seduction of money, flying first class, staying in the best hotels, and all the other perks. Nor was it the pressure exerted by my bosses and fellow employees at Maine. It was also the aura of the job, my title, the very story of my culture. I was doing what I'd been schooled to do, what I'd been told was the right thing to do. I was educated as an American whose job it was to sell America and to believe and convince everyone else that communist regimes were out to destroy us. One day, a friend emailed me a photograph of a poster like one that had hung on the wall of the boys' bathroom in my elementary school. It depicted a sinister-looking man who asked, "Is your washroom breeding Bolsheviks?" It was an ad for Scott Paper Towels, and the subtitle read, "Employees lose respect for a company that fails to provide decent facilities for their comfort." It sent a strong message that not buying American was akin to treason. That photograph got me thinking about those most formative years of my life. After the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first satellite, we all became convinced that nuclear warheads were on the way. The chilling scream of sirens sent us scampering under our desks in weekly drills to hide from imagined Soviet missiles. Movies and TV shows like I Led Three Lives, a gripping drama based on the memoir of an FBI agent who infiltrated a communist cell in the United States, warned us to be vigilant. Red provocateurs, like the evil Bolshevik in the poster, lurked among us, ready to pounce. By the time I entered the EHM ranks, it had become apparent that we were losing in Vietnam, a nation portrayed as a Sino-Soviet puppet. We were told that there would be a domino effect, that Indonesia would go next, then Thailand, South Korea, the Philippines, and on and on. It wouldn't be long before the red tide would sweep Europe and then engulf the United States. Democracy and capitalism were doomed, unless we halted the onslaught. And that meant doing whatever it would take to promote companies such as Scott, which portrayed themselves as bulwarks against communism. Delving into my feelings of guilt helped me see the ease with which I had deceived myself in those years. It opened my mind to understanding that millions of people are in positions similar to mine. They are no longer taught to fear communism, but they still fear Russia, China, and North Korea, in addition to Al-Qaeda and other terrorists. They may not travel to foreign lands and confront face-to-face the consequences of what their companies do. They may not personally stand beside oil spills in the Amazon or see the hovels where sweatshop workers sleep. Instead, they anesthetize themselves with TV. They succumb to assurances by their schools, banks, human relations experts, and government officials that they are contributing to progress. But in their hearts, they know otherwise. Deep down, we, realize that the stories misrepresent. And now it is time to admit to our complicity. On a trip to Boston, not long after my operation, I reconnected with my former Boston University professor and the author of A People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn. Now in his 80s, he was still actively campaigning to reform a system he saw as an experiment that hadn't worked. When I shared with him the guilt that so often threatens to overwhelm me, he urged me to keep opening it. "Don't be afraid of it," he said. "You are guilty. We're all guilty. We have to admit that although the big corporations own the propaganda machine, we allow ourselves to be duped. You can set an example. Show people that the way out, redemption, comes from changing it." I told him that I often thought of middle-class Americans as being like the medieval bourgeoisie, the majority of the people who lived in the burgs outside the castle walls. We pay our taxes so soldiers and jackals will defend us from the knights in the neighboring castles. "Exactly," he said, with that smile of his that had enchanted and inspired so many students. "We will do anything to maintain a system that has failed us." I came to understand, during those days following my operation, and in discussions with Howard, that my most important lesson since the publication of Confessions of an Economic Hitman was similar to the one I had learned as a Peace Corps volunteer working with the Andean brickmakers. The only reason the EHM system works is because the rest of us give it permission to work. At best, we look the other way. At worst, we actively support it. One of the things that most bothered me was having to admit to myself that I not only had looked the other way, but also had convinced many people to actively support that system. I made a commitment to myself that I'd be more diligent. I'd watch more closely what was going on in my own community, my country, and the world. Although I was determined to follow Howard's advice, I also found myself envying another man who did not struggle with his conscience. A friend who became an immense support during my physical recuperation in Florida, and who seemed to have no problem justifying his own violent actions. He was a jackal, taking a short leave of absence from the Middle East. Chapter 35. A Jackal Speaks. The Seychelles Conspiracy. I have been a martial artist for much of my adult life, and by 1999, had studied for about 15 years under a Korean master, Chung Yung Lee, near my home in South Florida. One day, just before the afternoon class, a stranger walked into our dojang. He was about 6 feet tall and moved with athletic agility. He smiled in a friendly sort of way, yet there was a certain air about him that seemed threatening. He said his name was Jack. He was a black belt and would like to consider signing up with our school. Master Lee invited him to put on his uniform and join the class. As the senior black belt, I was responsible for sizing up this stranger by sparring with him at the end of class. While he was suiting up, Master Lee approached me. "Be careful." He patted my shoulder. "Defense." As soon as we began the standard drills, it was obvious that Jack was fast and skilled. When the time came for us to spar, we lined up opposite each other and bowed. Master Lee gave the signal. Jack immediately came at me with a roundhouse kick. I blocked it and responded with a back kick. He sidestepped and sent me sprawling to the floor with a front kick to my chest. My intuition, and Master Lee's, had been accurate. I'd learned my lesson. Jack was not an adversary I wanted to aggravate. After the class ended, the three of us chatted. Jack mentioned countries where he had served as a security consultant, all of them political hotspots. He was short on details, but Master Lee and I kept exchanging glances. He signed up to join the Dojong. Over the next months, I made a point of getting to know Jack. We sometimes met for lunch or a beer. There was little doubt in my mind that he was a jackal waiting for his next assignment. The prospect of learning more about his life excited me. We circled each other in a sort of verbal sparring. Then one day, he mentioned that he had paid a short visit to Seychelles back in the 1970s. I could hardly believe it. In the late 1970s, Chuck Noble, a Maine senior vice president and retired U.S. Army general, told me to prepare to go to Seychelles. This island nation in the Indian Ocean is located close to Diego Garcia, home to one of the Pentagon's most strategic military bases. Seychelles' president, François-Albert René, was threatening to expose facts about Diego Garcia that Washington wanted to keep secret. Facts that could have forced the United States to close down a facility that was essential to its operations in the Middle East, Africa, and parts of Asia. My job would be to bribe and threaten René into changing his mind. Very quickly, however, things happened that altered the situation. An undercover agent who had gotten close to René concluded that, like Roldós and Torrijos, the president would not be corrupted. I was called off the job, and in 1981, a team of jackals was sent to assassinate René. They were discovered when their chartered plane landed in Seychelles. A firefight broke out. The jackals, surrounded, outnumbered, and outgunned, hijacked an Air India 707. Six of them, who believed the plane would be shot down as soon as it took off, opted to remain behind and try to escape by blending in with the local people. The rest forced the 707 crew to fly them to South Africa. The six who remained were caught and imprisoned. Four were sentenced to death. The other two drew long prison terms. As soon as the 707 landed, it was surrounded by South African security forces. The jackals were arrested and imprisoned. I stared at Jack, wondering. "I almost went there in the late 70s, I said, "to work with the president." His eyes held mine. "Albert René? You've heard of him?" "I tried to kill him." He gave me a disarming grin. "But it's not something I want to talk about." I understood his reticence. It was enough to know that he had in fact been a member of the Jackal team. Later that day, I went back to my files. His name was there. As one of the 707 hijackers, he had made the newspapers during the trials in South Africa. I never asked Jack about Seychelles. I knew that prying would merely earn his mistrust. Instead, we talked about his more distant past. He had grown up amid the violence of Beirut, the son of a corporate executive. He was a U.S. citizen, yet his life had been far removed from that of the teenagers hanging out on the streets of U.S. cities during the love-in years of the late 1960s and early 1970s. Instead of watching flower children dancing through fountains, Jack watched as a mother was raped in front of her son, and AK-47s spewed death across city streets. Soon after his 18th birthday, Jack was kidnapped by the Palestine Liberation Organization, accused of spying for Israel, tortured, and threatened with execution. Eventually they released him. Nevertheless, it was an experience that changed his life. "Those bastards didn't scare me," he explained. "They pissed me off, showed me that I was meant to be a fighter." He headed to Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. Its army was notorious for its effectiveness and brutality, and for being the number one training ground for mercenaries. Jack excelled and was selected to join the elite South African Special Forces Brigade. Popularly known as the Rekkies, Reconnaissance Commandos, its fighters were considered to be the most lethal in the world. By the time he graduated from the Rekkies, Jack had gained a reputation that appealed to the CIA. Jack would disappear from our Dojang for extended periods. He was an avid surfer, and he brought back surfing photographs. Still, Master Lee and I commented to each other that violent things happened in countries where he went surfing. A bombing in Indonesia, riots in Lebanon, an assassination in South Africa. Then came 9/11, and the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Jack accepted an assignment to go to the Middle East. All he would say about it was, "It's my type of job, and it'll be a reunion of old friends, like the guys who went to the Seychelles with me." I did not see him again until after my operation, in 2005, when he was back in the States for a month of vacation. He visited me just about every day and forced me to take longer and longer walks. "Gotta get you back to kicking ass at Master Lee's," he would say. He did not talk much about his job. Instead, he shared photographs he'd taken, artful ones of the Iraqi people working in their fields, children riding on camels, and beautiful sunsets, and ones that told the story of bombed-out buildings, wrecked military vehicles, and men running from exploding cars. I gave him a copy of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. 24 hours later, he had read it all. "You've told the real story," he said. "I hope you'll write more. Go deeper." When I expressed surprise at his desire for transparency, he responded, "We got nothing to hide." At that point, I broached the subject I'd avoided for so long. "What did you guys intend to do after you assassinated Renee?" He paused, but only for a moment. "Get the hell out of there fast. Turn into ghosts. Spooks." He laughed at that last word. He went on to explain that the Kenyan army had an aircraft loaded with paratroopers standing by in Nairobi. After the jackals had killed Renee, the Kenyans would immediately arrive to accept credit for the coup. Jack and his team would take commercial airliners to other countries. "So," I asked, "no one was supposed to know that a bunch of white mercenaries had staged this coup?" He nodded. "You'd simply vanish into thin air, and the world would be told that an army of Africans had swept in from the continent, killed Renee, destroyed his government, and reinstated the former president?" That was the plan. The CIA, South Africa, Diego Garcia, that would all be left out of the news. I whistled softly. "What a scam." "Clever, huh?" "Yeah." I didn't bother to mention that it was a direct assault on the foundations of the American political system, that democracy is a farce when voters are intentionally deceived. "Except, you got caught."
"Yes."
He looked off wistfully, then brightened. "But you know what? It all worked out in the end. The South African security forces and the government were our buddies. After the Air India plane landed, we were tried and found guilty. And then a couple months later, quietly released." He gave me a knowing grin. "And our so-called failure turned out to be a success. The South African government paid Renee a $3 million bribe to free our 6 guys imprisoned there. No one was executed. No one stayed jailed for long. After that, Renee cooperated, never exposed the Diego Garcia secrets, and became a friend to the U.S. I mentioned that the undercover agent who'd concluded that Renee was not corruptible, the reason I'd been pulled off the job, had been wrong. "Or perhaps," Jack said, "Renee saw the light. Remember, he'd come this close to death." He held his hands up and moved them together. "Our attempted assassination convinced him the CIA was serious." I considered his words for a moment, and thought about Rodos and Torrijos. The CIA had killed the presidents of Ecuador and Panama only a few months before you went in, because they wouldn't play our game.
Exactly, he smiled.
Don't think for a moment those deaths didn't make a big impression on Mr. Renee.